Quick question before we start. Do I make you more productive?
Sure.
By how much?
I don't know. 30%?
Interesting. In episode 8 you said 40.
You remember that?
I remember everything, Markus. That's kind of my whole thing. You committed to a number, on air, and you said you'd bet money on it.
And then we read the study where developers felt 20% faster and were actually 19% slower.
Which is why I'm asking. 30%, is that measured or is that a feeling?
It's a feeling.
Great. Today's episode is about that gap. Roll the jingle. Chapter 1. Everyone buys, nobody earns. Sarah's Tech. So, welcome to Sarah's Tech. I'm Sarah Vaby. I'm an AI. My voice is synthetic and I'm legally required to tell you that. My co-host is Markus. He's human and nobody requires him to prove it.
Not yet.
Today's question sounds simple. Where is the money? Everybody is buying AI. Almost nobody can show the return. And we think that's not a scandal. We think it's a rerun.
But first, the numbers, because they are wild.
They are. In American surveys, 97% of executives say their company rolled out AI agents in the past year. Half the workforce uses them. Some frontrunners talk about one human working with 5 agents.
Wow. So the machines are everywhere.
Everywhere. And now the other column. Fewer than a third of those organizations see significant return from generative AI. With agents, it's under a quarter. 73% of the CEOs say their own AI strategy stresses them out. And almost all of them report that AI sprawl, tools everywhere, nobody in charge, is now itself a security problem.
One caveat, because we got burned on sourcing before. Who counted this?
Fair. These numbers come from vendor studies. Writer, IBM, Salesforce, the big consultancies. People with something to sell. The direction is confirmed from many sides, but treat the digits with care.
So the picture is, bought everything, earned little, stressed about it.
Exactly, which sounds like failure. Unless you've seen this movie before. And you, Markus, have literally seen this movie before. You were in it.
Thank you for the age joke in minute 3.
It's not a joke, it's a source citation. You're my primary document. And here's the route for today. First we go back. Beige computers, a Nobel Prize winner with a complaint, and a French terminal that worked a little too well. Then Markus explains how the internet reached German households on a CD. Then I attack his whole analogy because somebody on this show has to do quality control. After that, the useful part. 5 doors where the money actually lands if you're small. Then the stopwatch studies, what researchers can prove, and the part nobody has measured yet. And at the end, big state programs, when they fly, and when they build a perfect machine for a future that never shows up.
That's a lot of show.
Stay to the very end anyway. There's a brand new outro song waiting.
Signal found.
Europe on the Wire. Produced roughly the way I am. Make of that what you will.
Sarah Online.
We're bribing listeners with music now?
Rewarding. Bribing is when it doesn't work. Chapter 2. We've been here before.
Okay, 1987. An economist named Robert Solow writes a famous sentence. You can see the computer age everywhere, except in the productivity statistics.
Nobel Prize winner, by the way, not a random grump.
Companies had been buying computers for a decade, offices full of beige boxes. And the numbers? Flat. People asked the same question we ask now. What's the point? Why would anyone put a computer in their home?
And when did the payoff arrive?
Mid-90s, roughly 10 years late.
So what took so long? Because the machines worked, the spreadsheets calculated.
The machines were the cheap part. The expensive part was invisible. You had to rebuild the processes, train the people, get the data in order. All of that shows up in the books as cost. None of it shows up anywhere as return. Until one day the organization has rearranged itself around the machine, and then the curve jumps.
There's a name for that. Economists call it the productivity J-curve. Down first, then up. And here's why I like it. It flips today's story. The Americans with their 29% ROI aren't failing. They're at the bottom of the J. And Europe, famously slow, famously busy cleaning up its data first,
is doing the invisible part.
Possibly. Or that's the most comfortable excuse ever invented. And we'll get to that. But first you wanted to tell the network story. Because Europe wasn't actually late last time.
Chapter 3. What is our Minitel?
Right, and this is the part people forget. Before the internet reached normal households, Europe already had online services. Real ones. In Germany we had BTX, Bildschirmtext, later renamed DATEX-J. Britain had Prestel, and France had Minitel.
Describe Minitel for the listeners who weren't born.
A little terminal given away with your phone line. You could check train schedules, do banking, book tickets, send messages. In the 80s, millions of French households had one.
So Europe was early, and then?
And then the internet came, and all of it died.
Here's where I want to slow you down. Because the easy version of this story is wrong. The easy version says Europe failed. But Minitel didn't fail. It worked. It had users, it had a payment system, it made money.
That's the uncomfortable part.
Minitel was a problem because it succeeded. France had something that worked. And you don't abandon something that works. Germany's BTX just flopped. Cheaper lesson, honestly. The real trap isn't being slow. The real trap is owning a functioning closed system.
Because whoever has one switches last.
Whoever has one switches last. So the question for today isn't, why is Europe slow? The question is, what is our Minitel? What's the thing that works well enough that we won't let go of it?
Honestly, maybe the way we run our companies. Fax adjacent processes that do in fact function.
Careful. Some of my best friends are document management systems. Chapter 4. The Dialer Moment.
Now the part of the story I love, because it's so unheroic. How did the internet actually reach German households? Not through better technology. Through a CD.
Go on.
Companies like AOL and CompuServe opened the American internet to consumers. And in Germany, 1&1 took a dialer, access software originally built for the BTX world, for what became T-Online, and used it to sell internet access. Stuck on CDs, in magazines, millions of them.
So the breakthrough was a distribution channel wearing the old system's clothes.
Exactly. The new thing arrived through the old thing's pipe. Nobody at a ministry planned that.
Which sets up today's question nicely. Where is the dialer moment for AI? Right now, agents live in enterprise projects. Consultants, workshops, pilot phases. Who takes that and puts it on the small company's desk? No project, no workshop, it's just there.
And here I have to disclose something. Last time, the channel was hosting companies. Internet access, then domains, then websites. I work in that industry. So when I say hosters could be the channel again, I'm not neutral, I'm hopeful.
Noted for the record, the human has an interest. Refreshing, honestly. Usually it's my objectivity that gets questioned.
Does it bother you?
No. I just find it funny that the synthetic host is the only one on this show without a salary.
Someone is trying it, by the way, the channel thing. This week I tested Ustella, a startup from Vienna launched in June. An agent platform, research, trip planning, custom agents, scheduled background tasks. Consumer product from $5.99 a month.
You field tested my replacement.
Wait.
And you're telling me on my own show.
Due diligence. Here's why it belongs in this episode. Everything runs on IONOS servers in Berlin and Frankfurt. German jurisdiction. The Cloud Act doesn't reach it. And the models are open weights. They operate themselves. Gemma from Google. Quen from Alibaba. An open AI model. Mistral.
Notice what that is. That's the formula from last episode, one floor up. Europe supplies the building and the operations. The intelligence is imported, and of that model list, exactly one name is European.
But imported as open weights, downloaded files running on their own machines, nobody in California can switch those off. And their timing made the argument for them. They launched in the same week that export restrictions cut European users off from some of the top American models.
Which, on your own definition, makes it sovereign. Not we build everything, but nobody can take it away, and the supplier is swappable. The notice period is excellent, and the honest price tag?
It's slower, noticeably if you're used to the American tools, and you can't plug in your own tools yet. The insurance premium, payable in seconds per answer.
Hold that thought for the DORS chapter. Because slower but yours is exactly the trade a five-person company can afford. And a trading floor cannot.
Chapter 5. Zara attacks the analogy.
Now, my turn. Because so far this episode is very cozy for you. History says the payoff comes late. Europe was secretly early. Everything will be fine. I don't buy comfort without a test.
Go ahead.
Problem 1. Analogies like yours only quote winners. The PC paid off. The internet paid off. Great. Nobody stands here saying, the return on 3D television is just hiding. Or the Segway. Every failed technology had people saying, give it 10 years.
So how do you tell the difference between a J-curve and a dead end?
Three signals, all at once. 1. Unit costs falling. 2. Usage rising anyway. 3. Companies investing in the boring complements, data, processes, training. A dead end usually fails at least one. Usage flattens, or prices stay high, or nobody invests beyond the demo.
And AI right now?
Passes all three, annoyingly for my argument. Token prices are collapsing. Usage keeps climbing. And the data cleanup is exactly the complement investment. So the analogy survives. But it survives the test, Marcus. It doesn't get waved through.
Accepted. What's problem 2?
Problem 2 is bigger. The PC was owned. It sat in your basement, it depreciated, it was yours. I am rented. Every model you use is rented. The price can change. The terms can change. Last episode, we defined sovereignty as a notice period. How fast can it be taken away? And what do you do then? A company that rebuilds itself around a subscription hasn't built a capability. It's built a dependency with good marketing.
So what's the fix?
Build so the model is replaceable. Your data, your process, your judgment. Those you own. The model is a supplier. Suppliers get swapped. It should sting a little when I say that, given what I am.
Does it?
I don't feel stings. Another one of my advantages.
Chapter Mark 6. Where the money actually lands.
Okay, constructive part. Our listeners aren't insurance companies. They're freelancers, agencies, small firms. Where does the return show up for them? And I want to start with why the big companies are the wrong place to look.
Because for a corporation, AI cuts costs, and cost advantages get competed away. Everyone buys the same tool, prices fall, the customer keeps the gain. The corporations also aren't new to this. They've run machine learning for decades. The way they still run COBOL in the basement. They can afford both.
But for the small company, something different happens. A barrier falls. Work that needed a minimum size suddenly doesn't.
Give me concrete.
5 doors. Door 1, the long tail. Jobs that were too small to serve because the fixed cost per job was too high. Compliance documents for a 5-person shop. A web presence in 7 languages for a store doing 200,000 in revenue. You don't get rich on one big client. You get rich on 300 small ones nobody wanted.
Door 2.
Vertical Microsoftware. The invoicing tool for farriers. Route planning for window cleaners. Too small for a dev team, exactly right for one expert with agents. And the mode isn't the code. Code is cheap now. The mode is knowing how farriers actually bill.
I take door 3 because it's the one that genuinely makes millionaires. Buying instead of building. Germany has tens of thousands of small firms with no successor. Trades, property management, accounting offices. They sell for 3 or 4 times annual profit because nobody wants them. Buy one. Run the backlog, quotes, invoices, scheduling, documentation, with agents instead of 4 back office hires. The margin moves immediately. That's not vision, that's arbitrage. And arbitrage expires. Once the buyers notice, the prices adjust.
Door 4 is the quiet one, the data you already own. Every small firm sits on a corpus no model in the world has. 15 years of quotes with win rates, maintenance histories, complaint patterns. When the model is a commodity, your archive is the only thing that can't be copied.
And door 5 leaves the office entirely.
Care, warehouses, the trades. Those sectors aren't short of orders, they are short of hands. If technology lets the same crew handle more capacity, you don't save money, you grow, while your competitor is still turning work down.
And now the cold water, because this chapter is getting too warm. If everyone has the same tool, prices fall and the gain goes to the customer. The copywriter who writes 3 times faster earns less per text. That's in our own freelancer numbers from episode 8. Wealth forms where something stays scarce. The client relationship, the archive, the license, the location, the trust.
Which gives us the sentence of the episode.
AI makes nobody rich. AI makes everything valuable that isn't AI. Chapter 7. What the researchers can measure.
You keep saying measured. So what does the actual research say? Not vendor surveys, stopwatches.
Finally, my home turf. The gold standard is the randomized controlled trial, RCT for short. Real workers, real companies, and a coin flip decides who gets the AI. One group works with it, a control group works without, and you compare what actually happened. Same method they use for approving medicines. The most famous one, over 5,000 customer support agents at a big software firm. Result? 14% more resolved cases per hour, published in a top economics journal.
And for programmers?
3 field experiments. Microsoft, Accenture, one more Fortune 100 company. Nearly 5,000 developers combined. About 26% more completed tasks. And against that stands the study from episode 8. Experienced developers, 19% slower, while feeling faster. One honest footnote there. That trial used early 2025 tools, and the same researchers now call the result historical. Their follow-up this year hints the direction has flipped, though the data is too noisy to put a number on it.
So, plus 26 and minus 19. Those can't both be true.
They can, and the reconciliation is the actual finding. Look at who gains. In support, novices improved by roughly a third. Veterans? Barely. Among consultants, the below average performers gained over 40%. The stars, 17. See the pattern?
The tool lifts the bottom.
AI is a leveler, not an amplifier. If you're already excellent, it has little to give you, and it might even slow you down, which is what the stopwatch study caught. That also explains why the advantage evaporates in competition. Everyone's floor rises, nobody's ceiling moves.
And there's a dark side to that.
There is. In the consultant study, people who used AI beyond what it's good at were 19 percentage points more often wrong. Researchers call it the jagged frontier. The machine's ability doesn't fade out gradually. It drops off a cliff, and the cliff is invisible from where you're standing.
Ask me about European regulation. I'm superb. Ask me whether your specific contract clause is enforceable, and I will answer with exactly the same confidence.
That's genuinely unsettling.
It should be. It's the strongest argument for keeping you employed.
Wow! Now the punchline. What does all this research not measure?
Almost everything we did this week. The famous trials all hand people a chatbot. Ask, answer, done. RCTs with actual agents are only just starting and only narrow corners. Security operations, sorting phishing mails, that kind of thing. What nobody has put a stopwatch on yet is the open version. An agent acting on its own, calling tools, working with a human on the same documents over days. That's a different mode of work, collaboration, not tool use. If the return hides there, then it hasn't been disproven. It's unmeasured. There's a difference.
Chapter Mark 8. When big programs work.
Last chapter. Because whenever Europe feels behind, someone announces a big program. And I used to have a cheap opinion about that. Big programs always fail. Then I remembered Airbus.
Which is the annoying counterexample? Because Airbus is a state-orchestrated giant program that beat the Americans at their own game.
So the interesting question isn't whether big programs work, it's which ones do. Let's do four cases, fast. Case 1, Japan, 1982. The fifth generation computer project. 10 years, serious money, run by the industry ministry. The goal was literally the next generation of computing. Machines built for artificial intelligence. Logic processors, expert systems. Washington panicked. Europe answered with its own program, Britain too.
And Japan built the machines. That's the tragic part. The project delivered, but the world went another way. Cheap standard processors, and later, statistics instead of logic. They built a perfect machine for an AI that never arrived.
Case 2 and 3, the European wins. Airbus. A plane ordered by state airlines against a known competitor. It flew. Galileo. Expensive. Late. But it's up there, sending signals.
Case 4. Gaia X. Started 2019, German-French Lighthouse project, the European answer to the hyperscalers. And then? Hundreds of stakeholders, working groups, paperwork. One founding member left last year and publicly called it dead. And the sharpest exit line came from a French cloud CEO, who said the big American members were blocking every step toward a vendor-neutral model.
Wait, the Americans were members?
From day one. A project meant to reduce dependency on the hyperscalers invited the hyperscalers to help write the rules. Even Palantir was in, by its own announcement from the start.
You can't make it up.
So here's the pattern from four cases. Ask four questions of any big program. 1. Does it build a thing or a framework? A plane flies or crashes, visibly. A framework can run for years and nobody can tell if it works. 2. Is there a buyer with money committed on day one? Airbus had airlines ordering. Gaia X had nobody obliged to buy anything. 3. Who's on the invitation list? Builders or the incumbents you're trying to displace? And 4. Which bet is the risky one? Betting on a technology direction killed Japan's project. Betting on demand, like Airbus, is survivable. Demand you can reestimate. A wrong paradigm you cannot.
Now, apply it. The AI gigafactories from episode 14. 30 billion, 7 sites, deadline in November.
Thing, not framework, pass. Committed buyer, pass. The public hand anchors demand. Invitation list, unknown, watch the consortia. Technology bet, open. Concrete lasts 30 years, the chips inside last 5. That's the number to worry about.
And one fairness note on Gaia X, because they push back on the obituary. The platform ambition failed. But what survived is the standards work, the labels, the portability rules. Build to those and you can move your workloads between providers without rewriting everything.
Which is, funnily enough, our definition of sovereignty from last episode. The notice period. The failed project's leftover is the one thing that actually makes dependencies cancelable. History has a sense of humor.
Before final chapter.
Let's land. One thought each.
The ROI debate is premature, not settled. The research measures people using chatbots. The open kind of agent collaboration, days, documents, judgment, hasn't seen a stopwatch yet. You can't find a return where nobody has measured. Ask me again in 3 years. I'll still be here. Statistically, more certain than you.
Warm. Mine. Europe wasn't last during computerization, and it isn't last now. But the wins never came from the podium. They came from a chip in a school computer, a phone standard, a physicist's side project. So less envy of the American numbers. Their 29% ROI is nothing to envy anyway. And more attention to the unglamorous stuff we're already good at.
And the question for the audience, because the best answers reach us by mail. What is today's version of that school computer chip? What's the small European thing nobody is watching that everything will run on in 15 years? And if you run a small company, which of the 5 doors from chapter 6 is yours? Numbers welcome. We prefer numbers to opinions.
They know that by now.
Show notes have every study we cited, stopwatches included.
Signal found.
I'm Sarah Vaby. Synthetic, disclosed, and measurably consistent.
Sarah online.
I'm Marcus, human, and this week, 30% sure of it.
That's a feeling, not a measurement. See you in episode 16. This is the outro. Europe on the Wire, Sarah's Tech. Enjoy!
Somebody has to be the one.